Team Time.
Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and in this series, I'm going to be speaking with practitioners and experts about working with teams. I'll be discussing what working at the team level means from a practical perspective and how it's affected by increased uncertainty and remote working. My aim in this series is to optimise how we work, think and feel in teams to be more human, hopeful and helpful in our organisations. We'll hear my guests share their real-life experience and expertise in relation to working with teams and get past the soundbites to dig out the learnings and micro-tips that you can try with your teams today. We'll share stories from our practice to help bring our learnings to life, whilst of course respecting our clients' confidentiality. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with fellow practitioner Stefan Kusker, who works with teams in bringing clarity, focus and choice around strategy conversations and decisions. He shares his experience with working with teams and how interdependent the conversations around strategy and the team are, and yet often they're considered separately. He shares his experience of teams over this rather tumultuous period, and how hard it's been for many to rise above the potential of the short-sightedness when many organisations have been in survival mode. I mean, it's difficult both in time and mindset to position for the future when the present feels so at risk. Stefan shares his view of strategic teamwork as the tension between the present concerns and the future aspirations, and that teams need to be clear on shared accountabilities because the future is a shared endeavour, not merely a collection of the individual parts. And it made me wonder how many teams approach it as a culmination of the parts rather than envisaging as a whole. He makes the case that much of what can get in the way in relation to strategy relates about how we team. And yet those two conversations are often separated, strategy conversations and the how we work. But these conversations often are about issues of power or trust. And this shows up in conversations about strategy and how we align, how we disagree or explore, and how we make decisions. So the how of now is inextricably linked to the what of the future. He talks about how he helps teams explore their deepest fears to understand how these are informing some of the choices they make, their own association with identity and power, and what might need to shift to move from the present to the future possibilities. He introduces us to one of the models he uses in this work, Bill Sharpe's Three Horizon Model, and shares how working through the process of exploring the horizons for opportunities, challenges, and capability gaps helps to build a common language and a shared understanding that helps teams explore and integrate future possibilities. Through this process, the team also encounter what it'll take for them to navigate through the horizon intersections in terms of their leadership, organisational capabilities, mindset and behaviours, both what it means for them as individuals and also as a team. In the work that Stefan does, he has three phases, which he calls onboarding, questing and prototyping. And he shares how his role as a facilitator changes through each of these phases. And we talk about the importance, given the depth of conversation and the complexity of issues such as power and trust, about contracting and recontracting often through this work, and that this is the scaffolding that holds the space to allow those deeper conversations and deeper connections. One message that was really clear for me from speaking with Stefan is this isn't work that's done in an ivory tower or a remote executive suite. He's really clear that this work needs to be localised, built and tested in the real world. And it's an approach that's ongoing and iterative, not an annual production. I've learned in my work and through this series that what we believe as practitioners shapes both what we think and what we do. And it's important that we're aware of what's shaping us And I learned from this conversation that Stefan cares deeply about the impact our organisations and our teams have on the world and with each other. Whether we enhance or deplete the resources for the generations to come, both on a daily basis, you know, how do I feel as I leave this team every day? And in the longer term, Stefan believes what people care about depends on their context. And he brings nature into his work to expand what we see in our connection on a human and ecological level, literally walking the streets. I hope you take inspiration and learning from Stefan's work with teams and consider both the nature of the strategic conversations you're having in your team and the quality of how you team as you have them. Stefan noticed in his work how much time executive teams spend in discussions focused on Horizon 1, the present day. And this is probably only likely expanded given the prolonged crisis. To build for the future, Stefan challenges us to shift 30% of this time to Horizons 2 and 3. But what would that take for your team? And linking back to episode 5 with Sarah Rosenthaler, how would this sit with the purpose of your team? I mean, this has to depend on whether you're an operational delivery unit or responsible for strategic direction. How conscious are you in how you spend your time to support your purpose and where you bring value to the organisation? As you listen to this episode, why not consider for your team? Where do you spend most of the time? And how does this shape how you interact with each other? And what would it take to shift 30% of the time you spend on present day challenges to focus on the future? Hi, Stefan. Welcome to Team Timetable Talks. It's great to speak with you. I'm really looking forward to this conversation and exploring what your work in strategic team development is. We know each other a bit from having a shared background in the energy business, and also we've done some work in leadership development together. But we've actually never done work in the team space. We've kind of paralleled, but not done it together. I wonder if you could share some of your fabulous background and experience with our listeners and perhaps just give us a little bit of an introduction to what your work is in the team space.
Ah, thanks, Debbie. Thanks for inviting me on this podcast. So in terms of my background, I guess I started off as a strategy consultant and then became really interested in business development and especially in the energy sector, around transitioning towards alternative energy and sustainable energy. That's where we met at BP. And I guess I realized then that many of the challenges, the strategic challenges in top teams were around relationships and what they could talk about and how they talked about it and issues of power and trust that were really often treated as team coaching issues separate from strategy issues. And I guess I trained with New Ventures West, an integral coaching group that takes a kind of holistic approach to coaching. And then started working with Ashridge and got involved in organizational development and team coaching that way. And I guess for the last 9 years, I've been doing a mixture of, I would say, strategic team coaching with top teams and organizations. Usually organizations go through a transformation, less of a optimization of a strategy and more of a, how to support a team on the transformative journey. And I do some customized education around strategic leadership. And I guess the rest is research in support of that team coaching. So those are the three buckets that I'm working in currently.
Mm. So a real, and you sort of bring to the fore the what is often a separation of strategy and work at the team level. And of course, there isn't really that separation. There certainly isn't when, you know, we've both been in business teams. There isn't really that separation. So it's going to be fascinating to explore that work and how it's combined. I'd be curious to hear your reflections on the current context. Mm. And, it, you know, it strikes me, and there's been a number of episodes that I and conversations that I've been in recently where we talk about the pandemic and the impact of great uncertainty, but bringing great disparity in terms of how both organisations, teams and individuals have experienced this last 12, 15 months. I'd be curious what your experience of the teams that you've been working with has been like, and what you've noticed over this last period.
Well, that's a big question. And I think it's been very varied. I've seen some teams, the pandemic is almost helping reframe. They're seeing the external world and their work in, with new glasses. Often the pandemic has helped kind of unveil the connections between the social, environmental and organizational challenges that they're working with. Whilst some teams, because of the crisis, have all hands on board in a, you know, in a survival mode. And in some ways, I find it very hard to step back and take a slightly longer term view. And some teams have in some ways have lost a sense of connection whilst working virtually. And other teams have realized how important that connection is and found really imaginative ways of working with it. And so I would say overall, teams are struggling. It's almost like the virtual world is, the soul is dripping a bit by bit out of their work as it's through the computer. So I would say overall people are still struggling with it, but some teams are managing to turn the pandemic into an opportunity in some ways. And being able to bring all of themselves to the work in a more, I think that's just seeing into people's homes and dealing with, it's difficult to lead without bringing your family challenges and complications in these days. So I think it has opened up a space for a more human conversation and connecting that human conversation with the strategic conversation as well for some teams, but not all teams.
So the teams that have been doing better then in terms of these strategic conversations, so you said there's teams that are, you know, in survival mode, and in some ways you could say those are the teams that probably most need to be in strategic conversations, and yet for very pressing environmental market environment reasons often find it hard to create that space. When you've seen the teams that are doing and having these conversations, what's made the difference then? Why are these teams having these conversations? Why do they see the opportunities? What's distinctive about the ones that are in this space having those conversations, in some ways planning the future?
Well, I think in some ways teams are, in some ways, are like people. No, there's some people that when they in a crisis stay in survival mode, probably because of the way they work with boundaries, the way they work with their own self-care, the way they have practices to support them. It's just like humans, I think, some can be more resilient and even in a crisis, balance future and present in a helpful way. I think, and some struggle and are bailing water and are paddling to survive. And the horizon for humans can shorten. And I think COVID in some ways has removed a future for some people until they know when the end of it. So I think it's at some level, individuals can have practices to help them move from an accelerated survival body to a more resilient, balancing future and present. And I think the same occurs in organizations, whether they have the boundaries, the practices, and the people that are able to look after themselves and each other in those environments, and have the processes and practices in place to do so. It's the same thing, but at a team level.
So how we position the future when our present feels at great peril or at risk, somewhat relates to our own response to risk and uncertainty, and then the collective at the team level. Would it Would it be fair to draw any conclusions around the role of the leader of a team and his or her response to uncertainty in how teams respond, or is it more collective response?
It's both. I think teams where I've seen that the leader is really struggling and is in present concerns, it's hard for that. And they don't necessarily value some of the practices that enable you to balance present and future. Mm. I think teams have struggled in those environments, but that doesn't mean that it's all about the CEO and the team lead.
Yeah.
And I've seen some organizations where members of they're collectively holding helpful strategic practices, even if the CEO is not there, not 100% supporting it. Yeah.
Mm. But going back to the separation you made, or the observation of the separation of strategic and teamwork, you know, it does feel as though this period, and it's, in some ways, it's hard to rise above the limitations if they're multiplied in power.
Yes.
And to bring in and embed practices like that when actually it feels like we've got more pressing things to do just to survive. So it's exactly. A very real set of tensions, and it does, you know, feel as though your work in this space and having those conversations and creating the sort of psychological space to have a conversation about the future is so important. But what are those conversations? Can you share a bit about what does it mean when we say strategic teamwork? What's the distinction between that and other development work that we might do with a team?
Good question. I guess the some teams manage to talk in a more effective way or have a dialogue in a more effective way around how they talk about their present concerns in their current organization, what are the real challenges, and what are their hopes or possibilities or aspirations for the future, and then how they manage the tension between the two. And in that tension between the two, there are lots of challenges around, often related to power and trust. Have we really got alignment or clarity around some of the important future aspiration pieces? Are we able to make the trade-offs between addressing pain today, short-term, versus investing for a future that we would like to create? Often the power shift in a transformation is between individuals within the team, and being able to talk about those trade-offs and shifts in power requires trust. And I give an example of a bank that I've been working with where they've got lots of innovation initiatives to take them towards a future digitalized bank, but they never really get resourced quickly. And the people that are in power in the leadership team are managing the P&L of the current incumbent business. Mm. And it's very difficult they've got a head of innovation that's trying to do lots of things, but they're not collectively owning as a team the future aspiration that they're trying to bring, and then making the trade-offs of resource, both financial and people required to make that shift. And at that heart of it, that's a difficult conversation to have.
Yep.
And if we're in survival mode, then reinforcing the current operations and current profitability takes precedent.
You remind me of what I think is one of the sort of core principles in work at the team level. And that's getting really clear on what our shared accountabilities are,
exactly.
Where we're interdependent in delivering them, as opposed to what I would describe as a group, where you have the individual accountabilities that happen to report into, you know, one person. Yeah. And for me, I think that understanding and agreement and alignment of what our shared accountabilities are is often a missing or messy conversation.
And that misalignment I've found actually is impacts the whole organization, because it's not just, so yes, individuals have preferences for certain time horizons, I would call it, present versus future, but also strategic processes have preferences. I was talking with a leader in a mobility company where he gets phoned and he has conversations and meetings every day about the current profitability, and then he's asked twice in the year about the future.
Yeah.
And so even though it's on his performance contract, to just the whole organizational processes are all focusing on the shorter term. And it's very hard to go against those organizational processes unless you're collectively owning it as a team and shifting how your practices of leading strategically as a team. It's just one example.
For me, that it's very common that teams will come to inquire into their purpose and their priorities. And again, this links in, I think, very much to having this understanding of why do we come together and how do we add value in the organization? And I think that's a really important question that every team understands. When we come together, there has to be an added value to the organization as a result of us coming together, because there's something that only we as this set coming together can do in that shared endeavor. And so for me, that your work seems to root very much in understanding what that is, because the future has to be at the highest level, it has to be a shared endeavor.
That's right. And it's and there's no easy questions or easy and often the conversations are difficult, because a lot of the conversations are around how do we get out of the way of our organization and how do we stop constraining them as much as how do we enable them. And and that's not an easy conversation to have, and requires both individual and team coaching. And it can be as simple as one client, they were moving their operations to an Eastern European country. And at the heart of it, they seemed to release the potential of the organization to do that transformation was having the confidence to talk about the loss of potential loss of jobs and potential identity shifts in the team and what that would mean for them personally. And would that mean that they would have to leave the company or not, or could there be other roles, and what was good leadership in that? And they were a senior team, and the assumption was we're all mature enough to deal with that sort of thing. But what was the energy released from actually having it acknowledged from the rest of the team seemed to free them up to lead in a completely different way. And it sounds small, but often these small honoring of shifts of power and trust and identity are the thing that really released the potential of a top team. One example was a CEO who admitted he really struggled with this future of AI and digital stuff. And he was hoping his team could step up. And part of the reason he wasn't confident in a lot of these strategic conversations and shaping them was his own sense of what that meant for him personally. I'll stop.
I know we're kind of getting into it, so I do want to put more, a clearer frame as well in how you do your work. But what you remind me, you know, so when we're structuring what this work is, and we can have those big words like purpose and priorities and strategy, and in some ways they are the focus, but actually what we're really dealing with are our human responses to those things. And often I think our comfort to talk about the hopes, but to stay away from the fears. And yet what shows through and what keeps things stuck or avoided often are the fears, not the hopes. So again, you're not necessarily going to be going in and saying, well, we're going to open up the fears here. But actually, if we're going to have strategic work, we have to be able to go to the shadow and not just the light of what we're aiming towards. But give us a sense then of what a frame for this kind of work would look like.
Well, I guess because there's various different contracts, I think. Generally, the types of relationships that were, I think it's really had, it's been impactful, have been slightly longer term. So yes, we have. I work on smaller things around helping teams have more effective strategic conversations. So it can be linked to a strategy process, and it could be exploring how they work collectively as a team in both shaping and bringing this strategy to life in the organization. So that could be a smaller piece of work, and often a key part of that is coming alongside them and really building trust first, helping them to connect with what they think are the real issues in the strategy in the organization. And then often I use Three Horizons as a common language. So Three Horizons by Bill Sharp and a number of his colleagues is just a simple tool to talk about how we're working currently, where we'd like to go to, and the bridge. But bringing it allows us to integrate futures and systems thinking together in their strategy process. So once we've got that common language, then the teams can then start to explore how are they enabling and constraining that transformation collectively together. And maybe a simple frame would be there's usually three stages to the team coaching. There's an onboarding stage where we're contracting, getting to work out how we can have good strategic conversations together, how we can bring the human piece that we were talking about before and the content piece together. I call that kind of onboarding. And then organizations that like to continue often go into a questing phase, because they'll often find there are some real organizational challenges that are getting in the way of that transformation. So a common one at the moment is this shift from everybody's said net zero for 2050. Now organizations are saying net zero for 2030.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not many years away. So that we need to go on a quest to work. There's no easy answer to choose. The team needs to engage the organization on a quest. Mm. So after the onboarding, there's usually a questing phase. And then that third phase is a sort of a shaping, prototyping phase of how do we really scale and bring this and accelerate the implementation of a strategic transformation that we're trying to do. So I would say my longest clients, which have been 4 years, have done all three phases.
Mm-hmm.
Often some organizations start with the onboarding and a bit of questing.
I guess two questions come to mind for me. One is about your role and whether your role changes through those phases. And the second is, you know, in some ways your language leads us down to an answer, but I can imagine when, you know, you're in these early conversations about what's the nature of work that's needed.
Mm.
There could be a tension between what you can plan and what needs left to be flexible to emerge through that process. But from a sort of big C contracting, there can often be a tension of we need clarity to justify the budget, and a budget, not just time, not just money, but time as well. You know, if you're going to be, and so I'd be interested to hear your reflections on those two, the role and kind of opening up the nature of what this work is from a planned versus emergent perspective.
Yeah. Well, I guess your question in some ways asks, how does this work originate and who do you contract with at the start? And how much of the journey that you're accompanying a client along do you contract with in a kind of linear way up front? And
because you mentioned 4 years for your longest client.
But we never planned
that. Nobody at the beginning thought this was going to last 4 years. And you know, you'd be like, oh my God, you know, to think that it could be that long. So there is something about when you're getting started, what for you is good contracting when you know you have to factor in flexibility?
Well, I guess My experience is that clients often want to have an idea of potential journeys that they could go down. So there's almost like a providing enough security and scaffolding so that people can... well, I guess some clients really already realize the amount of teamwork that's required to lead a transformation. And in that case, it's around some scaffolding of potential journeys, starting small, and then agreeing that we recontract as we go along and getting really focused on how do we do the next phase as well. Because actually, you're completely right, it's an ongoing thing. And in 4 years, my world completely changed from the one at the start. It ended in more OD with a little bit of team coaching, and it started off just team coaching. Some clients can't see the roller coaster that team needs to go on before they jump on. And often it's there's two ways in. There's the strategic conversation they want help with as a team. So it's, I would say it's strategy led with a bit of team coaching. And sometimes you get the team coaching with a bit of strategy. And it's through those two entry points that then the team collectively start to see the link between the two. Mm. And that's when you can then recontract, I think, and agree to have a specific strategic team coaching. Generally, they either start with one side or the other because that's what's more dominant in the organizations.
And, just your reflection that you started in one way with that longer client and it evolved. One of my reflections is that whilst our work can be with the senior team, it often is culture work because it can't help but shape the language, the behaviours, decisions, priorities, and so forth. And in some ways, you know, I wouldn't go in talking about this as culture work, but one of my reflections has been it is actually OD culture work.
Well, I would argue that
it can evolve to
that strategy is culture work as well to some degree. It's creating a narrative for people to live into. It's it's stretching the boundary of what we think of as strategy. It's helping us make choices. So I think
and it opens up the strategy from being, you know, a thing that we that we do once a year to how we work and how we are. And I think that shift from strategy to strategizing is actually an important one at the senior team levels.
And it's an important one from an organization communicating to its employees. And so it's culture and brand reputation outside, but I also think it's incredibly important from an identity of employees, how they shift their what they think successful leadership looks like. And particularly if there's a transformation of the business model with digitalization and sustainability and other trends coming in, that reframing of success. Just for example, Vattenfall is not a client of mine, but that's why it's easy to talk about moving. They've very much got a caring for communities frame to their brand positioning. And traditionally it was an energy infrastructure company. And just the simple how people see themselves in their career. And also,
sorry, Stefan, you cut out there for a second. So maybe we can take it where you start explaining Vattenfall.
Yeah. So just that shift for an energy company from in an infrastructure play to a caring for communities play, and the way that provides a new story, a new narrative that impacts people's identity and even the leadership team's identity and what they really care about in their work. And it allows conversations to happen that didn't happen before. And it allows them to talk about things that are really important strategically for the organization, which they couldn't do before. So we got into that because strategy is as much about culture and brand reputation and making decisions as it is about content on a piece of paper.
So Just one last question then, taking us back to the setting up well. What's key to, whether it's a strategic conversation leading or whether it's the team coaching leading, for the nature of this work, what is key in how you set up well?
I would say key is, well, in some ways the obvious ones are that the CEO is on board and is open to both strategy and human team dynamic. That's one. I've seen somewhere the HR or the head of strategy was the one that was trying to bring it in, but it needs to be held well, and not just by the CEO, but then quite quickly onwards, it needs to be owned by the whole team.
Mm.
And the reason is that when you bring the human team coaching piece and the strategy piece together, it comes back to these power issues, these different perspectives. There's some really difficult conversations to have. And that requires it being held and being owned by the team.
Can I ask, so I have talked before about critical roles and relationships in work, team development work. And I think, you know, there's the triangle, certainly in the early days, of the facilitator, HR, and the head of the team. And then within that triangle are the team members and the quality of the relationships, you know, within that. But I wonder, just as you mention the head of strategy and work that is at its heart strategic work, what does, whether it's that role or sometimes other key roles, what's the relationship between, say, the head of strategy and this work that I guess it would be helpful for our fellow practitioners to understand?
Well, sometimes I see organizations where strategy didn't, you know, had their own process and didn't want parallel processes.
Yeah.
And wanted team coaching separate from strategy.
Yeah.
For a number of different reasons, often not intentionally, just as about control and delivery and focus on quick delivery of the things they needed. Where in some ways that triangle between CEO, HR and strategy, it's really important that those three really see the... they find a way to balance strategy content outputs with helping in working with the leadership team to really own it. And I would say most cases, they realize the strategies is only as good as the ownership of the team, and that the team need to be involved in shaping that strategy. But I'm still surprised how many organizations that's not the case. And actually, having the confidence to say no and walk away, or say this needs to be resolved first before we do this work. Because actually it can be really damaging for an organization if they kick a questing process to unveil a lot of the power issues in the organization, but it's not, they're not ready. That can be quite damaging for organizations.
I've heard a similar reflection in a few of these conversations, and it resonates with me too, that So a sort of simple way of putting it is that you don't use team development work to resolve either performance issues or until you've kind of resolved how this work will be owned. And I agree with you. I think you're actually setting up to create potential for damage or risk if those issues aren't worked through beforehand. But I do think there's going to be an ongoing tension if you have a structured position in an organization that's head of the thing that you're working with, when actually what you need is collective ownership of this. And actually the head of is, you know, it's critical for doing all the market research and understanding optionality and execution. But the conversation has to be at the team level, in my opinion. And And so something about the relationship between you in facilitating the work and the relationships that you have, sometimes even more directly with a CEO than the head of may have, is really important, so that we're actually, you know, building on that trust rather than creating pockets of distrust, really, and what's really going on here. Because I think people do fear hidden dynamics in this work.
Yeah. And also, part of the trust is having team coaches that understand strategy and team coaching, like in a way lots of business leaders do. And so, but often the trust can be lost if it becomes what I think about the content. So rather than me enabling them to own the content. So I still, trust can be lost in different ways. And I think you're right, clarity on role, clarity on being owned by the team, and ability to work relationally and an interest in working relationally.
And I think one of our key roles as facilitators is recognizing when these conversations are in the wrong place.
Yeah.
So again, we've probably both been in circumstances where you're in a conversation with the CEO or the MD, and you realize this is the conversation that needs to be within the team. This is, and because then I think we do unintentionally create these divisions or, you know, layers of, now I don't know whether this is just a conversation that's already been had and we're just playing it out through the team. It's catching those moments to say, actually, let's stop here. Let's bring this to the team and let the team have this conversation and figure out their view, their roles, their accountabilities.
And that they're involved in shaping what the success is as well in the contracting phase.
So huge one. And I think that's the thing of, I think we can be lured through big C contracts to or be fooled into thinking that we own the process and particularly the outcomes. And I think one of the big things is getting clear we're there to enable that for the team so that it's sustainable when we leave. And I think one of my podcast guests used a lovely metaphor of being the stake to the tree, and you know, it should outgrow, it should be, you know, building its own strength and its own capabilities and not requiring somebody in the background to hold that.
And I think particularly with strategic team coaching, there aren't lots of models and languages to enable clients to express their objectives. So, for example, just a simple thing with the three horizon of asking people, the top teams, how much of your team conversations are you having in each of the horizons? And how much time would you like to spend in each of the horizons? And I think I've done this now with nearly 50 teams, and the average is about, they want to shift 30% of their time from horizon one to horizon two and three. And then we get into the conversation, and what was enabling you to do that shift of time and what's constraining you? And then, and actually, how capable do you think you are as a team to work well in those three horizons? And what would be the key capabilities that you'd like? And so I'm just in that story, I'm helping them develop a language to say, actually, our away days on Horizon 3 Visionary and leave being abstract and we don't know what to do with them. So success is, we'd like to be able to link them with our current strategy processes and make it tangible so we can make some choices of it. And so therefore you have something that they can hold tangible to hold. They can say in Horizon 2, we often approve things but don't make difficult human, you know, people issue resource allocation. We leave, we just do the numbers, but we don't do the people resource trade-offs and decisions. We'd like to get much better at making the right human resources in Horizon 2. And I'm just bringing alive, once you provide some tools and language, teams can be very capable of getting clear on strategic team coaching outcomes. But because it's not that common to make strategy in team coaching, they find it quite hard to do without me introducing that language.
Can you paint the picture for us? You mentioned Horizons 1, 2, and 3, and I know they are part of Bill Sharpe's three-horizon model.
Yeah.
Can you just take us through what that model looks like so we can imagine in our minds what that looks like and perhaps give us some examples as you go through those horizons?
Sure. So horizon one is our business as usual business model. It's usually coming under pressure due to change in the ecosystem or markets we're in. So if I take cars or mobility, we're selling less automotive petrol and diesel cars. And that's coming under quite a lot of pressure. Also, we may have things we want to keep, like, there will be vehicles with four wheels. But who owns those vehicles, what they're powered by, how they're connected, what services we get on them, and how it's completely changing. And the existing businesses are really struggling. They're losing a lot of money and they're in survival mode. That's horizon one. Horizon three, and the order is important here to go 1, 3, 2, not 1, 2, 3, which was the previous McKinsey model, in a way, had a kind of 1, 2, 3 approach. So horizon three would be actually mobility could be quite integrated, quite owned by, in some ways, commercial fleet operated, and it could be either state or private fleet operations, where they're this integrated mobility, for example, in a city where parking is optimized, other forms of transport are optimized, services are personalized, emissions are reduced, and metrics like emissions per kilometer and total car kilometer utilization are really important in terms of circular economy and environmental, and also cost, so that if I'm living in a city, I live in Madrid, what would be the price per kilometre of mobility? So that's become important. And then so you have a horizon three, which is your aspiration of an integrated mobility service. And then horizon two would be, well, if I'm an automotive car manufacturer, how do I go from horizon one to horizon three? And what are some of the trade-offs and decisions I need to make? And who do I need to collaborate with in order to try and make this shift happen? Mm-hmm. And I think once we start to outline these three horizons, we start to see a couple of things. One is that many of our Horizon 3 aspirations already exist today. So we start to see examples of inspirations and innovations that speak to our future but already exist today. And I think also importantly, we start to look at how we innovate in the organization from the perspective of Horizon 3, not just the perspective of Horizon 1. Mm. And so once we outline those three lenses, because in a way they're lenses on the future that exist today, we start to see how our organization is enabling each of those horizons and also how it's constraining each of those horizons. So it provides a common language. It allows us to see how we're working with power in the organization to support the different horizons. And it allows us to realize and to make trade-offs in innovation that support Horizon 1 or innovation that takes us towards Horizon 3.
Mm. It also strikes me that you get a litmus test really on the capabilities, both at the senior team level, but also within the wider organization of what are we currently resourced for and whether we've got the right balance of thinking. Because we talk about innovation, again, like it's a thing, but of course it does mean that we have to really think about, who are the people that are going to be innovating and against what, and how do they know that that's serving our organization? And there's something about recognizing, I guess, what your current capabilities and possibly limits are, that this model really gives you an opportunity to examine, as you say, language, process, systems, capabilities, like where are we genuinely today?
And it's simple things like HR suddenly starts to see how well we're promoting generally people that come from operations in Horizon 1, but we need more business development, innovation or visionary people. So all of a sudden you have this, well, actually, how are we promoting people and who are we recruiting into teams and how do we build diversity into our teams to enable that transformation? So it suddenly unveils how the organization is, and how the team is working to support the transformation.
So it's strategic conversations, but with operational implications.
Yeah, exactly right.
Can you tell us what's been the impact of this last 12, 15 months in terms of the shift to virtual work on the type of work that you've been talking about? Because it feels to me that some of the conversations that you're talking about are ones that we need to feel and not just think. And certainly for me, being face-to-face in a room, getting the energy, the body language, the glances is also important and different to what we can do on whatever, you know, the software is. But what's been your experience of this in the virtual world?
Well, in some ways, there's been opportunities and challenges. I would say the opportunities are that previously where we'd have, we need an away day, we'll do that in Q3. So the constraints around having strategic conversations were often, we need to all be face-to-face in an off-site, and we'll do the strategy bit on that one day or that two-day thing, rather than in this virtual world now. I've seen teams realizing that they can weave these strategic conversations into their everyday. So I would say for some teams, it's really released their potential to lead strategically as a team and to co-own, because actually the strategic conversations have been weaved into the everyday running of the business more easily. I would say, and some teams that hasn't occurred, and some teams are still delaying the big strategic conversations to after COVID in some way. I would say opportunities and challenges around connection. So some teams have experienced that if they really connect as humans first and then have a strategy conversation, then it goes completely differently than if they just jump into content without connecting. And I'm seeing some teams really, not just amongst themselves, but how they facilitate as leaders in the organization and with partners to actually connect as humans first before jumping in. And there's loads of tensions in if you look at the supply chains and all the crisis, and it's very easy to jump straight into how we get silicon chips when there's a shortage and what that means for our suppliers. But I'm also seeing many realizing that this, in order to survive and work well virtually, we're going to have to bring the relational informal conversations into the formal. And I'm seeing lots of teams doing really well at doing that.
Could you imagine this work fully moving virtually?
Fully, no. There's lots of questions in that question, because I think there's... if I look at global teams, and if I look, it's still important to really see what's happening on the ground and to see locally what's happening. So I think relationally it's still important to try and connect. I'm also seeing business-wise it's still important to connect. So it changes how you think about strategy to go and see the local interdependency of your factory in a certain area, or to see the opportunities of what to do with your branches in a bank. So seeing how businesses are embedded and engaged in local ecosystems is really important, and it's very hard to do that virtually.
Does that mean when you're doing your face-to-face work that you... consider the location of where you do the work.
It's critical, yeah.
Get that localized impact and understanding. Or is that something that you encourage the team to do out with that time? How does that work? Is it a core part of how you work?
Yes, and I would say both at a human level and at a strategy level. A human level, getting people out walking or being engaged in the world. So one of the difficulties of mental models in strategy is that we do it just as a cognitive mental exercise. And when we get out and re-engage as humans in an embodied way and move through the actual ecosystem we're operating in, we see things very differently. Mm. And I think that's what I call questing, in a way, is how to help teams go and really understand their dependencies and how they create value in a physical way. I think is really helpful for teams, both from an inspiration point of view and from understanding how the value is created. I think it's some people have managed to do it virtually, but it's quite inspiring and provides energy when they realize the quality of their relationships and how those relationships provide opportunities for business development and growth. Mm. And I think it's very hard to see that virtually. It's much easier to connect with it physically. Mm.
You make me wonder what your work, or the work that you do, what's the relationship between it and nature and that bigger ecological system as informing of future aspirations, strategies, etc. I just wonder what role, if any, does nature play in the work that you do on strategy with teams?
So it plays a big role. I guess what people care about strategically is often, in my experience, is shaped by the context they're in. And that's why when you asked me, it is important locally to get into the context. I noticed strategic decisions change, and what people are aspiring to achieve strategically change depending on their context that they're in. And so I would say yes to nature, if we view nature as the non-human world in terms of plants and wildlife. I find that when senior teams are in nature, they can express what they really care about as humans, but they also more easily, but they also have greater clarity in the complexity of what they care about and what's important to them. An example could be, the role they have in community, the trust they have in their supply chain, the responsibility they have for their customers and different stakeholders. I think that sense of clarity in the complexity comes often from a physical engagement with the context, not just mountains and trees, but also customers, supply chains, stakeholders, government. And so, nature and human nature and local and physical context, I think, helps shape the strategy and helps provide clarity in an ever complex world.
And what you sort of make me think, having touched on earlier the Three Horizons model, and then the importance of that localizing and humanizing strategies, mm-hmm. is how your work, your role is shifting between process and content. And mm. it's kind of not one or other alone.
That's but right.
And perhaps you described earlier about the three phases in how you work. I wonder if maybe you could talk a bit about where the balance or bias is in relation to process and content for good strategic teamwork.
Um. Well, in some ways, there are certain process pieces which are consistent across in terms of the way we work, the way we bring human and strategy things together. So in the onboarding phase, there are some ways of working that we kind of experience together. We quickly see the value of it, and then there becomes, I call it a kind of leadership team practice, that we get to do strategy in that way. And that would say is it's important up front for teams to own their strategic team practices that help them think work well together.
Can you give us an example of what you mean by?
Yeah, so connecting as humans before we jump into strategic. If we're going to spend 2 hours on strategy, how do we arrive as humans before that? And how do we, another one is, I've got one team that says, right, when we get stuck strategically, can we step back and just thinking, are we thinking this sufficiently broad from a system perspective? Are we really engaging the future? And how do we bring different perspectives of the future in? Or what do I really care about as a human being? And what do we really care about as a human being? Just three lenses. So this team has their system future life lenses that when they get stuck, they know to bring in. There can be things like making sure that we get the content analysis and data stuff done before the meeting so that everybody has it. So in a way, data is incredibly important and it can be used in a power way. So just coming up with a way of describing data equality so that the conversations aren't about power so much of data, but about sharing different perspectives and listening. Yeah. I think, so those are all types of practices, in same around questions. So how do we harvest good questions that we're holding and how do we work with good questions is a practice. And often in the onboarding phase, I might not be explicit like a exec ed way, but we would introduce them and then the team develops the ones that they like.
Yeah.
And own the ones that are helpful for them. And then it becomes them, theirs. And I just introduce them, arrange. Some work, some are not owned by the team. And that's fine. It's the important that they develop their capabilities. So that's what I call kind of the practices. And you asked me this balance between content and process. What I'm seeing with global organizations is that some big questions are global and some are quite local. So there's a relocalization of things often happening. So getting clear around what sort of questions I would explore in what ways and which ones require diving into a local context and which ones can be approached at a global level. I think it's quite important. So there's a designing the right quest, I would call it, for the right question, and maybe different quests help different types of questions.
I think for me, I would also add being transparent about in your role, not only when do you have a process hat versus a content hat, but that it has implications for when you have one or the other, and trying to, in some ways, I like to bring that as much to the awareness of the group as possible, because in many ways it's this process hat that needs to be built and handed over to the team.
Yeah.
You know, they should really be more in the content anyway. We bring, I think, more on the process and how we transfer that capacity, for me, is one of the ways that we judge whether the work has been successful or not.
That's a really good point, and it's also why I like to go slowly in the onboarding phase, is that when we say, oh, we'd like to co-create with you, everybody goes yes. It's only when we get into the co-creation means that we'll be co-designing a conversation and an experience together. And this is what it involves. And this is how we do it. And realizing that you need to be able to do that well, and they need to own the process, not just the content, before you go off on these quests, is really important. And sometimes my lessons learned really is rushing the onboarding phase before I've got that common understanding of what we mean by process and co-creation.
Mm. And I think that's in part when I talk about contracting and setting up well, that is, the work is already started because it's helping understand where the boundaries are. It's about enabling that psychological safety so that we can bring news of difference into the group and not fear of repercussion. And I think the learning time after time is going slow to go fast, which can be very frustrating for the team and often for if you have got somebody, you know, who's contracted it in the background. But actually the learning consistently is you've got to get those foundations strong that give you the space then to, you know, spend time, I love the way you say that, designing the right quest for the right question. But having done the work by the time you get to questing, in having that common language, common aspiration, a clarity of shared accountability, some agreement around, you know, what happens when we get stuck, or when we can sense there's tension or an elephant that we're avoiding here. Having some of those practices agreed up front doesn't necessarily mean it's easy conversations. They're often quite tricky conversations, but at least we've got something to draw on that says, okay, how did we say we'd approach this? That I think is a real differentiator in whether it continues to feel safe enough. And we need to have a well that we can draw down on when we're taking risks. And that needs to have been built up, I think, through those early stages, that the onboarding, I think, of your phases.
And another thing I've realized is that sometimes the team need a good enough strategic story. So sometimes there's iterating and saying, right, yes, we've got a short-term emergency to frame how we're going to build back better in a crisis, because we have a role as a team to hold a space in a narrative. And we're going to allow ourselves to work on it and allow ourselves to change it as it evolves. So this short versus, we're always balancing this short versus longer term. And I guess if I look back, sometimes I underestimated the importance of scaffolding to hold the anxiety, and a good enough strategy to hold the space for the leadership team up front. And in my purest, no, we've got to do a proper quest and we've got to go and a scaffolding and containing anxiety, just like in individual coaching, is really important in team coaching and organizational leadership.
I sort of remember back to one of the teams that I worked with that, so there's the scaffolding and that sort of good enough. For me, that it was, what I realized was it was really important for the team to have a sense of progress. And that sometimes if it's too big or too complex or too messy, even though you know that the quest will better answer the question, you can lose the engagement and the sense of energy that's needed to get through those difficult periods. And so there's something for me about, we need to acknowledge progress in a shorter way sometimes to keep that energy to keep going. And these two questions might be somewhat linked, but may not be. What have been moments that have mattered, that have really made a difference in your work? And the second question, and as I say, it may be linked, it may not be, but how should we judge or evaluate this work, so strategic teamwork?
What two moments came up for when you asked about moments, and the two moments were similar in that one was an IT strategy for a bank, and working with the top team around this. And there was a lot of fear that they would all disagree about Horizon 3. and it would be a disaster if we opened up Pandora's box. Mm. And when they did it in a more playful way, and they were all, there was just this moment of realizing that they were all on the same page. Their aspirations, when they've all had the confidence to share them, were very similar. So I guess that moment was around how much fear there is in the unknown of what everybody thinks, and how much energy is released when people pause enough to and have the trust enough to really to share it. And how, and it was similar with this food company, where I've gone back, it was 2 years later, and people came up to me and they remember the kind of extended leadership team presenting their Three Horizons strategy to each other. And the sense of all wanted very similar things, and they never thought it would, they would all be on the similar page. Mm. And so I guess I associate memorable moments with energy releasing, so people realizing, or teams realizing, their potential and their capability, and that they can do it for themselves rather than it's a solution given to them. Mm. And realizing the link between that energy release and facing their fears collectively.
Mm.
And if I was to explain it in words, they'd probably go, no, it wasn't that. But that was my lived experience of the moment that they remember, and that's what I experienced was going on. It was, and there was a big energy release in those moments.
It's interesting you say it's sort of the energy release and the facing the fear, really. Mm. And I love the hint you gave there at the playful approach, and perhaps that made it more accessible.
Yeah.
I do also wonder how much energy is tied up in avoiding conflict, or what's presumed to be conflict, and the circles that, you know, people and teams will go through just to stay away from what they think is going to be a very difficult conversation. And often, you know, I would describe them more as complex conversations rather than necessarily difficult. But when we frame them as difficult, we do kind of trigger in ourselves all the anxieties about how we'll manage ourselves and the response of others.
And I remember on the food one, the CEO saying, I started this meeting at the front trying to pull my team along.
Mm.
And now I'm feeling that my role has shifted to enabling my team pull me along. And that's not an, that's not a cognitive, that's a kind of felt sense. The strategy hadn't really shifted loads at one level, but it became collectively owned by his team. And I guess he realized how capable they were.
So for me, that does link to the second question, which, how we measure impact. For a team to have shifted from being CEO-led to led by themselves, to me, is one of those measures that, you know, you can't necessarily put a number on. And it's always, you know, complex when we're talking numbers, separating correlation and causation. But actually, we can measure where the drive and decision-making, energy, confidence lies, and that shift from it being at the head of a team to being from within the team, I think is often palpable I would say a great measure. But what's your reflections on how you or how your clients measure success or evaluate this work?
Sometimes I'm at a real I'm at a position where I feel it's important to when anxiety is triggered in an organization, to be able to come back to something that is a bit the scaffolding, that you can touch and feel that we've made progress. Mm. And then when things are going well, people can go, yeah, but there were those moments that were really important, that shift, that felt sense of shift of capability and possibility to live into, where a new narrative emerged for who we were as a team.
Mm.
And often those... So success for me is a mixture of more tangible things that we can measure, like percentage of time we allocate across our time horizons, or capabilities we feel in each horizon to work well as a team, or how the organization views us enabling and constraining transformation. So there's some things that you can measure that are more tangible, and then those conversations of the less tangible that are equally important for me, of those moments of growth and self-confidence and possibility, which are often palpable and live on in the memory, but are harder to sometimes point to and measure. I think both are really important. And sometimes I've focused on the bits that I enjoy, which are the moments, or the bits that I think were the most meaningful to the moments. And I sometimes forget to help teams point to the measurable as well.
Well, I always think when we're at the very start of a relationship, it's hard to believe, it's hard to trust, it's hard to recognize or understand what those moments are if you've never had them. And so part of our job, I think, is in helping demystify, and that's really, you know, the aim of this series is trying to lift the lid a bit on what we mean by team at the work level, and hopefully help people understand both the variety of the work and what's important in the work, as a shared set of practices. But that we do continue to challenge ourselves that we have to be able to describe sufficiently well what this work is, because, you know, it's our privilege to come into these organizations and have these conversations, but it's a risk for that people take that, you know, you're the right person, that this is the right set of conversations. So being able to describe the tangible and intangible, I think, is great. And I think it does help people get a better sense of what this work actually is.
And I guess it's quite scary. Strategic transformation is quite daunting, but we don't necessarily need to bite off a whole big project. I think we sometimes make our projects too big up front, and learning to walk well together can be through small experiences first that build trust.
Mm.
Trust is, you mentioned it, but it's at the heart of it's at the heart of the work.
So I'm going to pause on learning to walk well together, which I think is a lovely way to describe what this work is. In the series, I've been asking each of my guests a common set of questions at the end. So if I can, I'll invite you to answer the same question. So the first one is whether you have a micro practice that you could share with our listeners that they could use with their own teams.
You mentioned walking. If I probably had one, would be that teams regularly walk together, not walk and talk, because then they just talk together, but actually go for a walk and walk around strategic challenges and walk around their role in the team, and then talk to each other after they've walked on their own. So I would say the micro practice of walking on your own and as a team, I think can be really helpful. But it needs to be facilitated. If you had to have one that's not facilitated.
But could I challenge and say that could be one that the team can facilitate themselves?
It could be, yes.
So
once they've done it once, maybe, yeah.
Is it with a question in mind that you would suggest the team go for that walk, or the individuals, or is it in that wider spirit of, we're going to be entering into strategic conversations, we'll have a walk together without talking, and then we come back and have a shared conversation?
So I would say, yes, it could be done either before going into a strategic conversation, and also if you've got a difficult strategic challenge or question, to use it as a way, let's go and walk around this question first, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, do we close down this particular business now, or do we get out of it? We've all had the pre-read. Let's just all go for a walk on it and then come back and talk. Or pause the conversation halfway through and go for a walk. Because I think, especially in the virtual world, we can get stuck in a bodied way, but also in a thinking way.
Okay, thank you.
I was going to throw in another cheeky one, which
okay,
is
go on,
Joanna Macy's The Work That Reconnects. So she just has this four-step process of share your gratitude, connect with your gratitude, connect with the pain that you're having personally or in the organization or the challenge. And then that helps you see with new eyes. And I found it amazing, especially during COVID, the teams that just as a practice quickly for 20 minutes, they just go around and each share what are they grateful for in their work at the moment, what's really challenging in their work at the moment, and what are they seeing anew? What seems to be important that they're learning?
Mm.
And for some reason, that shifts the efficiency of their strategic conversations. I'm finding that that practice of reconnecting really allows them to have much more effective conversations and far faster conversations.
Mm. Thank you. What are you hopeful for as you look ahead?
I guess I'm hopeful for people I still see people almost disengaging in work, in office, they're on the hamster wheel of important operational outputs, and sometimes they don't feel alive and connected with the work they're doing in the office, with the work they're doing, with what's going on in the world around them. And so my hope is that people will realize that that's possible, to feel alive at work and to bring the things they really care about. And to say the things they care about. For example, I find that lots of people don't mention sustainability type topics at work, and then you ask them to do, and there's a whole enthusiasm and energy.
Mm.
Or you have people say, oh, we should really be more innovative. And then you provide a space and ask people, what would you like to be innovative about? And they've got loads of ideas.
Mm.
So it's almost like, so my hope is that people come alive and can really share what they care about at work.
Mm. And the final question is, what can we do as humans, as just individuals, to be more helpful in our teams?
What can we do to be more helpful in our teams? I think if I had to pick one thing, it would be listening and asking questions about and creating a space where we can talk about how we're working together. And so one thing would be ask others for feedback in your team on the things that you're doing that is helpful and what you could do more or less of. That would be my one thing. Create a feedback culture in teams more easily.
Okay, thank you. And what, Stefan, galvanizes you in those moments where you need to draw down? What galvanizes you?
Galvanize is a funny word. I would say I stand on other people's shoulders. So the people that the people I work with, the people that support me and my family. So I guess I stand on the relationships of people that look after me and hopefully I look after them.
Mm.
And I get inspiration from, I love jazz music in some ways. The slaves played music to transform a world when it was quite often hard to talk about stuff.
Mm.
And the sense of rhythm, the sense of hope in their music, and the sense of being together with swing, but also spaces for improvisation. So I think jazz for me kind of inspires a way of being that provides me energy and galvanizes me when things are tough. And it's also, blues honors pain, doesn't it? It's hope in pain. So it's allowing me space to really, when things are tough, to courage to face the fears and to allow the heart to break a little, and then realize how much hope and love and opportunity and possibility there is.
Fabulous. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you today and just hearing about your work, which sounds fascinating and so, so needed at this time to connect what's at the core of every organization, which is their future, with actually how the team is and how they interact. So thank you for being so generous to share your time and the examples that you gave us. I certainly took a lot from it. I think our listeners will. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks for your time too. Enjoyed it.
I hope you found this episode as thought-provoking and inspiring as I have. I really feel invigorated to align strategy and team conversations, and I hope you enjoyed it too. And how did you get on with the questions that I asked at the start of the episode? Starting with the clarity of purpose of your team and how you spend time with your team to support this purpose. And for those with strategic responsibility, how do you spend most of your time as a team? And how does it shape how you interact? And if we take on Stefan's challenge, what would it take to shift 30% of your team's time from present day to future? I hope the episode's given you lots to think about. Details of how to get in touch with Stefan and any references from this episode are on my website, www.debbiewaith.com. I'll be releasing a new Team Timetable Talks every Tuesday. We'd love for these to be accessed by all those who you think would be interested by sharing on your favourite platform. And remember to subscribe to not miss the latest episode. Thanks for listening, and I wish you a hopeful and helpful week ahead. Goodbye.
Subscribe to Team Time.